Nicola's going to read for the first part, and then we're going to have a conversation. Nicola Dean's first pamphlet, My Moriarty, won the Flairstack Poetry Pamphlet Prize. Her work has appeared in magazines such as Poetry London, Magma, The Shop, The Moth, and Yesterday's Child, which is in the new pamphlet Trieste, published by the Poetry Business, was highly commended in the 2014 Forward Prize. So I'm really glad to welcome Nicola Dean. Thank you.
Evening, folks. It's just lovely to see you all here, and it's lovely to be back in Ledbury. I try and come here every year for the festival, but this is the first time I've been here out of season, as it were. In such a gorgeous room as well, so I feel this is a real treat. And thanks to everyone for coming. In some cases, I know a fair distance. So, okay. I thought I'd start with My Moriarty, the title poem from the first pamphlet, partly because I was thinking today about breakthrough poems and which ones change things for me, and this poem is one of those. It kind of comes from my fixation as a child with partly with those Basil Rathbone Sherlock Holmes movies. I used to watch them endlessly on a Saturday afternoon, and I used to love the way he said the word Moriarty. He said it kind of mostly down his nose, as I seem to remember. Maybe that's just my kind of misremembering from childhood. But and then I think one day I was, a few years back they revived it with Benedict Cumberbatch and so on, and there was an article, and I think it had Moriarty in the title, and then just the title came to me, and that was it, and that's the only time I've ever had a title come first before the poem, and I tried to write one version of it, and it failed, and I wrote a second version, and then it came out like this. So, okay, My Moriarty. Up on the Reichenbach Falls, Moriarty, just you, me, and a flattering rainbow-hued nimbus of mist. You with that spidery voice, all machinating, echoey, hoaxy-coaxy, or the ursine growl you used to show who's boss. I've been onto you for years, one step behind, not quite solving you, my darling conundrum. And still I wake at night, wondering whether I could pick you out in a lineup. Doubtful, I know, when I've only ever glimpsed you, Profil Perdu, slipping through the crowds of extras in the overpopulated palaces of dream. Yet I'd swear I've memorised the contour of your cheekbone, mentally sketched the curve of your right eye socket, the way the corner of your mouth lifts when you smirk, having foiled me again. Bored of defeat, my God, how I want you, facing me at last, your fizz inked in, not smudged in charcoal, glimpsed in mirrors or flickering from passing trains. You who are coattails, teasing letters in code, the man who paid up and left just moments ago, let's agree for once, you'll skip all that. Of course, we'll need some rules to make it sporting, like momentary presence, eye contact, but nothing that smacks of the future, of staying forever. So trust me, relax. You'll like what I do when I catch you. And of course you can slip the knots I'll tie, but not before, in the tussle of the denouement, you try the ways I've found to make you shout my name. Okay. And just to go back to another fairly old poem, but one that I've revised slightly. Unlike My Moriarty, which seemed to just happen, once it decided to happen, this one has shifted a little bit in a couple of incarnations over the years. So it's in My Moriarty, and in a slightly revised form I'm hoping to put it in my first collection. Okay, so this is Through Ida Hammershøi Almost Discourses with Rilke About the Pianoforte. It's got a long, strange title, and it needs a little bit of explanation. The Danish painter Hammershøi lived in he was working at the turn of the century, and he lived very much in seclusion with his wife. I don't know if you've seen these canvases, these very kind of sparse canvases, and it's usually his wife, often with her back to the viewer, sometimes playing the piano. Okay, and they seem to live a very intense existence. And one day they had a visit from the wonderful poet Rilke. Rilke was interested in doing an interview with Hammershøi, except for that it didn't go particularly well because Hammershøi was so I don't know, so withdrawn that he didn't say anything, pretty much. You know, it was very silent, very tense. And I wondered, after finding out about this, what was going through her head as he was visiting. So that's where this poem comes from. Okay. I play facing a bare wall. I play to break our silence like a loaf of bread. I play because he no longer delights in my face. I play to play time out of itself as rain is played from cloud. I play because in playing I send the day back where it came from. I play like the single candle sounding the dark of this room. Most days I would rather play than kiss or eat or talk. Yet some days I'll play into the eye of the waking sun, then stop. Some days only as dusk plays me and all the white keys, black. And then there are those days, like water through closed fingers, where I don't play at all, where I sit and listen to the ringing of stilled strings and resonate, wishing away all liking, labour, lack. Okay. And again, thinking about breakthrough poems, I wanted to read this one because I don't normally read it at readings, and I just felt like saying hello to it again after quite a while. When I've really started to write seriously and actually take it seriously, that moment really was when I'd just given birth to twins, and I was on maternity leave, and I was trying to basically breastfeed twins, and I was doing really well with it by this stage, but it was hard going. What I would do is I'd feed the twins and I'd have this enormous feeding pillow around me, and then once they'd gone to sleep, I'd have a little book stand in front of me, I'd have my poetry book, and I would sit there and write. And I sat there in the semi-darkness doing this, and days passed by, weeks passed by, but in that particular period, on one day, on specified day, I don't know which one, this poem happened. I've been reading some John Glenday. I don't know if you know Grain and that poem. Is it Imagine You Were Driving? I forgot the title right. Anyway, just that poem, and then suddenly this happened. So, and it relates to a camping trip I did in Carrigskeagh One a number of years ago with he's now my husband, we were sort of hoping to run into Michael Longley, who's got a house there, but it didn't quite happen. Anyway, this is called I'm Going to Carrigskeagh One to Look for Michael Longley and Not Finding Him. We found hairs on the macher, but not the form of the hair. We found the sands and dandered there, but no footprints of the poet's sand-starred Wellingtons. We looked at the waves of the sea and willed a sea otter to surface, but the waves only churned with an otter-like sinewy motion. So we pitched our tent on the windiest headland in Mayo and looked for water, which on the first night was only a trickle, and gathered driftwood for a fire. Driftwood so pale, smooth and moony, it was too precious and delicate for burning. Still, we burnt it anyway, an offering to the moon and ocean, in a scrap of cover like a form, a notch in the lee of the headland. That night the wind filled our tent wall like a sail, and all that was there was the wind that was leaving and leaving, so loudly we didn't hear until after dawn the torrent the storm flung down to run over the bed of the burn. We tried to sleep through that storm, and embracing like strands of kelp, stirred by strong currents, washed by a tide of air, dreamt not even a dream, a half dream, an eclipsed dream of a dream. Okay, and another poem. It has a similar feel to it, kind of a wilderness feel to it. This has got another sort of poetic feel to it, in that this poem takes place on Uig in the Western Isles, and we booked a holiday there, and then looking at the map after we'd booked the cottage, we realised that we were actually just really, really close to the beach at Mangistar, which is the title of another John Glenday poem. That holiday became very special for me for that reason. So. But this isn't on Mangistar, this is called Towards Swinevar. It's a mountain near where we were staying. This is taking place in the presence of a mountain, before the sheep crop dungy grass, between exposed ridges that make the rock look threadbare, the mountain bony, a mendicant in rags. Follow my finger up to the resting places of the mountain, the deep grooves still glacial, still missing their smock of ice. Nakedness in rags, the bones of a thing in rags, unwilling to plead. But there can be no resting place for the weather moving over the mountain. Clouds reflexively turn their faces from the summit, saying it is to be watched with an averted gaze, spectacle of a queen turned beggar with no domain. How does a mountain occur to you? How can it? I cannot ask you to reach and touch it, or rather I can, but your hand won't find it. You can come looking and still not find it, and yet it's present. How can it not be, now that I've said the name? A mountain happens to you while its strata stay put. It is slipping forever under your thought, remaining and remaining, while you can't help but move through time and space like a leaf unleashed from its tree. The mountain is not your home, should you hope it might be or fear it might be. It is home to nobody and owes nothing. Whatever is unwanted or unlovable in you, or too wanted and too lovable, would soon die of exposure if left out on its high ledges. And so your heart quickly climbs and descends it, leaving a girl child, a sickly elder there. Okay, now, I think I was just, right, so I think I want to go on now to look at something from Trieste, or a few from Trieste, rather. Okay. So, I'll start with the last poem, just to be a little bit, just turn myself on, I'll turn things on its head a little bit, on the head a little bit. And this poem, Trieste, went through a couple of different incarnations. I've written at least two poems called Trieste. The first one was very different to this. And it's based on a visit that myself and my husband made to a friend who's doing a PhD out there at the university. And we took an EasyJet flight, and the airport was some distance from Trieste itself, so we had a quite long bus ride going in. And as we were driving through, I saw a brown sign on my right, and it was for Duino Castle. And I almost had a heart attack. It was just so, I was so excited. I thought, I'm this close to Duino Castle. This is just wonderful. And that proximity to Rilke was just, even though we didn't actually go there and visit it, was still wonderful. So the poem really kind of draws on that excitement. And also a spectacular storm, because I think we were the only people, myself, my husband, and his friend, who were swimming in the Adriatic in February. The locals were just looking at us like we were completely crazy people. Trieste. Our thin futon mattress on loose parquet, white sheets, the sanctus of our skin. Then light wakes me early, a coolness, doves. Morning comes like a proof, grief balancing two hearts, where what's between them is held like the bubble in a spirit level. Crooked, violable is the way of the angel, a candescent road. Later we'll lark in the tideless winter sea, then turn our faces back to the sky to find it carbon, dark as the Lord of Hosts, all those scepters of lightning. Here, a few miles down the coast from Duino, Rilke's shade still asks the sea wind what is coming, what approaches, and whether, like a Spartan messenger, runs in, breathless. Okay. The next poem, Bold, is probably the only workshop poem I've had that I felt really happy with. I love workshops and I love doing them and they're really wonderful, but for some reason the poems I've written there haven't quite always hung together, but this one did. And it was a Karen Ann Duffy workshop, and what she did was she got two bowls on the table, one of which was full of objects, pieces of paper with objects that we had to write down, and the other was emotions. And what I drew out of the two bowls was bowl and confusion. And afterwards, strangely enough, I asked people around the table and nobody could remember putting the word bowl in there at all. So it's just a bit bizarre. Anyway, it all came together when I remember the when I was writing it, it came together quite quickly, and it came together partly because I remembered this little phrase from Robert Frost, which is the kind of tagline on the poem. So, bowl, drink and be whole again beyond confusion. Or wood, or bone, or mud, or plastic, or silver, with a family tree as long as history. What are you, split skull? What don't you know? If we've forged an axe, we've dreamed a bowl. If we've made a fire, we've made you a home for food, for bread, a womb for bread, for wine and water and milk into wine. But what are you for, if not for everything? A room for absence, open to the sky. A home, but not a roof. We might say, a love without its shelter. You place no seal on your pure hollow of praise, praising's tomb. And if dust touches you, it sleeps in an eyelid bed, in half a world singing the lay. Be here, be whole, be gone. Okay, this next one is a dad poem. I try and balance up dad and mum poems in when I do readings, just for fairness' sake. And this is, my dad's a great storyteller, and this is one of his stories about going on holiday to Spain in the early 60s. I think, I hope he doesn't mind me saying this, but he just split up with a girlfriend, either just before the holiday or actually during the beginning of the holiday. So he found himself in Catalonia on his own, talking to people in bars and things, and this story comes out of that. And at a time, obviously, as you'll remember, Franco is still in power. Okay, so it's thinking a little bit about that. L'Estartit, my father in Catalonia, 1961. Careful. The barman jerked his head a little towards the closing door, thumping as if punch drunk on its hinges. Careful, senor. Special police. Guardia Civil. And stepping back from his gaze again, carried on revolving and polishing, with plain white linen, a clean, warm brandy balloon, so that there would soon be no hint of fingerprint, those telling walls and loops like Celtic beasts, no cloudy planets of human grease on its surface when he raised it, a breathed-on empty chalice up to the one small source of natural light. Okay. And this next poem, I haven't read for a while, but I'm quite fond of the circumstances in which this came about as well. I have a wonderful recording of Donald Justice, and it's an Academy of American Poets recording. And on it, he's talking about, I think it's a poem, Bostock, and he says something like the first line of this poem. So the first line's not from a poem of his, it's just an occasional remark of his. Cityscape with invisible dog, after a remark by Donald Justice. My dog is in the poem, though he isn't mentioned. He trails along behind me in my sadness, his leash not quite at full stretch, working his nose up and down the regularly spaced lampposts, squeezing his nostrils like a concertina. You will not hear these inhalations in the poem. The dog is in the rain, but a different rain, which soaks him, but is otherwise no tribulation. Rain he does not howl at or invest with feeling. And when he lifts his leg in graceful attitude, it is to make a delible stink in the world. Okay, and here's the mum poem. This is something that takes its starting point, some lines by Anne Carson from Red Dog. I've compressed them into one long line. It's called Coming Out of the Lake into a Big Towel and Her Arms. When the mother opens her arms to her child, the corners of the towel in either hand, what is it that moves me further, deeper? The thought of my running to some such embrace, the great imprecise blur of running and memory, not a lake, but a bay, day's end, and the warmth, the double warmth of cloth and arms, her spilling smile and running that way to my mother, to be her smile or that smile's excess, or the thought of either of my sons doing the same, and that face that was hardly hers, coming into my face like a sunset, breaking my love right down to its colours, my face dissolving then into the base of all feeling, night welling in my face, dissolving, reaching the root of every love. Okay. And this is Yesterday's Child. This poem was just a gift. It happened very quickly, and I hardly revised it at all. In fact, I put in one word. I changed one word, and then I sent it off to the Rialto, and Michael McMinn at the Rialto picked on that exact same word and said, "Why didn't you change it?" And I went away and looked at it, and the change I came up with, it took me a few hours to realise, was the original word from the first game. Yesterday's Child. Sorrow and rage, rage and sorrow, a bead on a thread of ragged prayer. And yesterday's child can't cut the string, and her life is strung on thin, thin air. She knowingly, doggedly sewing tomorrow with sorrow and rage and sorrow. Very cathartic, that one, wasn't it? Right. Three Shades of Black. This poem kind of proves that you don't always understand your experiences when they're actually happening, because there's a reference to Rothko in here. I went to see a wonderful Rothko exhibition, but I think I saw it after the Hammershow one, and I walked out of the Rothko feeling kind of, is that it? No, I didn't really feel very much, or so I thought, until this poem cropped up, and then I realised actually it had affected me more than I'd understood at the time. Anyway, Three Shades of Black. Here, clothe yourself completely in swathes of lorca black, better to absorb the noonday sun, or strip to enter this flinty dun-keld burn, troubled with its own brightness, weaving and wilding its black snow water, yet beading clear on the swimmer's skin. Either way, you'll end as you must, a cold, burning, starless black, Rothko black, dense mineral on black ground. Okay, and I think from here, there's one more in here, just check. No. So, this marks a change now into newer poems, and I'm putting together a full collection at the moment, and hopefully these poems will be part of that. The first poem is called Cuckoo. When I was a kid, my introduction to poetry was really one of them anyway. There's several different ones, really. One of them was, I don't know if you've had it, have a copy of it, but Helen Gardner's, I think it's the Oxford Book of English Verse, with an acid green cover. It's very, very bright. And I don't know whether that drew me to it to begin with, but it's a big fat anthology, and I don't think I ever, at the time when I was little, got past the first poem, which is that summer is he coming in louder sing cuckoo. So that's really where this comes from. Plus the fact that we do have cuckoos in the village where I live sometimes, but I haven't, it's scaring me because I haven't heard one for, didn't really hear one last summer. Anyway, cuckoo. When the buds on the birch disappear, I appear, so spooked, het up, heaven fretted, bejesus, souped up, with all the maybes in May, the new plight of the May. Cuckoo, cuckoo, to chant us back to the sleeping presence of the greenwood. Like that? How so? With a wake for a voice, my loopy echo, a bit of locus pocus. I seem to have got a bit obsessed with totalitarianism. There's the Estatique poem, and then there's this poem, Akhmatova's Dream. You know, given the times we're living in, I don't think it's entirely surprising, really, but this poem came about a year or so ago, maybe 2 years now. It has a little epigraph from Akhmatova's, instead of a preface to Requiem, 1st of April 1957, and she says, "In the terrible years of the Yitzhak terror, I spent 17 months waiting in line outside the prison in Leningrad." She was, as I'm sure you know, she was waiting for news of her son who was imprisoned there, and this imprisonment was kind of held over her head as yet another way of trying to terrify her into submission. "Ear to prison walls, they stay with me, listening, in stoop step, these ranks of women wintering, waiting for news, my army of sparrows. Their wronged shoulders, their frisked expressions, souls for the moment, like vases flaking in frost, blinking as if robbed by a laughing guard of spectacles, blue-lipped, tongues all but frozen to their palates in what remains of their song. They turn back to me whenever I sleep and look. Through the white space between us, ice crystals abrasive in fog, beginningless blizzard coming on again like a migraine, needles of snow. Whenever I sleep like this, the hail-hard headscarves, the moon-scar faces, turn back to me and look. Speaking of Donald Justice, I really, really, really love Men at 40. It's just a wonderful poem. But it always just, I kept reading it thinking, the women, please. And it just cried out for this kind of response, really. And I tried to write one when I turned 40, I'm now 44. And it just didn't happen. And then I wrote a poem, and then I realised that the title might well be Women at 40, so it happened that way around. Anyway, and it's very short. Women at 40. Women at 40 wake to find they are the mouths of daffodils calling yellow, yellow, yellow out of rogue frosts, the unwarmed earth, last year's leaves, a bee-dry spring. Okay. This is called Chimps. I almost wanted to call my collection that, but I think there's a play called Chimps already, so I thought maybe not. I think mostly the references are fairly self-explanatory. It was sparked by discovering I had lots of allergies as well that I didn't realize, I didn't really have before. They've kind of crept up on me. Chimps. On reflection, I like the 20th century better. When I was only a bit sniffy this time of year, around the long grasses, thinky with seed head, the one-trick buttercups, the work-shy Jesus loves you roses, especially the city of Belfast's my grandad bought with PG coupons in the 60s, back when they still used dog chimps in costumes to advertise tea bags, and we would spray the deeply frou-frou pink for black fly without a second thought. Okay, I have no idea of the time, so I think I timed it earlier, but it's roughly okay. Right, so I'll just do this. This is a longish poem, not the longest poem in the collection, but this is called D-Day, and it's in memory of my grandmother. My mum was adopted, so this is my real grandmother, whom I met towards the end of her life. D-Day. You tell them then, because our planes are flying over everyone and have been since dawn when the engines woke you, because their drone note, its guttural swarm, hums through your bones and the sky has invaded your ear, because even these friendly squadrons seem to have you in their sights, because a plague of angels is over you, death birds you will see with closed eyes like eye flaws or black wizened tears years afterwards. Because these angels of vitreous dust have shot from you a blast wave of grief, a Jericho, as you say out loud to your parents' tightening, draining faces, all you can smuggle past your shame and yourself to reach the lips of the story, hoping they won't do what you know they'll do when you tell them. Haven't you already packed your valise in the dawn light? Spare underthings wrapped round your shrinking childhood, your foreboding. You tell them because you, more than many, know at 17 what soldiers do. And because you don't need a Bible to tell you, you and your small passenger will both be half Job, half Eve in this world. 2. 7 months of knowledge hidden under ever looser clothing. 7 months of my mother within you, my secret mother, my mother your grief, my mother the love no mother mothered when you could not keep her, until I kept the secret of her, for her, safe within me, until I woke to the sound of the Lancasters, Spitfires and Mustangs within her, and dawn until midnight mother grief, like that longest of all days. Thanks very much for listening.
It's really lovely to get the span of work, isn't it? Right from first pamphlet all the way through. So I think that was really lovely. Thanks for giving us those. So as always, please do chip in if you have questions, and I'll ask as well at the end. So feel free to do jump in. But I was going to say, because it seems to me you often, you know, you've spoke about some of the poets that. You spoke about John Glenday and mm-hmm. with such passion. So I must ask you about you. I'm going to ask you who's influenced you and how you feel that's kind of worked its way into your work, or if it has, if these influences have. Because I don't know John Glenday myself very well, and I don't know how much.
John Glenday is an early and late discovery. I came across him in my early 20s, when he was published by Peterloo, and I think I met him at the time, went to a reading of his, and obviously, I don't know if you come across his work, but he's been fairly legendary for publishing one book every 15 years, something like that, and quite often very small, delicate poems as well. So I love that sense of dedication, the fact that, you know, you're prepared to wait that long for the right stuff to actually come to you. So yeah, he's an important person to me, but and people like Donald Justice, but Donald Justice is quite late. The early influences I was thinking about today, you know, people like Wordsworth, actually, you know, just that stuff of being studying people for A level. We did Wordsworth for A level, and there's something about learning some of those poems almost, well, pretty much by heart, or sections of them by heart, that went really deep in, you know, that idea of seeing into the life of things and look at, and his brilliance about perception, you know, depth of perception. Mm. And then, of course, there's people like Bishop and Lowell, and on this side of the Atlantic, very important to me, new generation poets as well, because that's when I really started to get interested in contemporary poetry, was the new generation thing back in, I suppose it would be 94, 95. So, Don Patterson, Michael Donaghy, Kathleen Jamie, Ian Duhigg. So those are only some of them, really. I mean, it was such an amazing bunch of people.
It is interesting that you've said about having these poems that are kind of coming back and back again in different ways and different titles. Because there's a Moriarty poem in here as
yes,
well.
Yes, a second.
And this, and so... What's happening there then? Is that how do you think? Because you've also talked about poems coming together and that sort of thing, something that happens. So what's the two? How is that?
It's just such a mysterious and exciting process. That's why I do it, because sometimes it works very quickly like that, and then sometimes things take years and years to percolate. And I love the idea of not understanding what I'm doing and being surprised by things. I mean, with the Moriarty thing, that I just thought that was typical of Moriarty in a sense, because I'd had the first Moriarty poem, and then I wrote this very strange poem, which was actually an exercise. You know, the Glyn Maxwell book on poetry, and I think it was one of the... He does these seven exercises, and I did this one. I wrote it, and then I thought, I know who's been, you know, behind this. It's flipping Moriarty, isn't it? So it had to have Moriarty in the title, so... You see what I mean? That was a surprise when you realise these things.
Yeah.
I find that really exciting. You know that you can't really judge how anything is going to go. And even poems you think are terrible, sometimes there's a reason why you've written that version of the poem. And if you just persist with it and you go around the corner a little bit, something really great happens. With, you know, a new version arises, or you get a different poem on the end of it. I mean, Yesterday's Child was like that. I was struggling very, very, very hard with another poem, trying to rewrite it. It wasn't happening, and I was like, and then I just kind of let go. And as I let go, that poem, Yesterday's Child, went whoosh, there it was, you know, and I didn't even try with that one. I'd just been doing the trying with the previous poem, and when I stopped trying with it, there it happened, you know, that's what happened.
Yeah, so. Yeah, that's really interesting, isn't it? Because I suppose I feel I want to then ask, but how do you know then if you've kind of got it? And I suppose I ask that because some of your poems do make those lovely leaps which marry together sort of two things that are either... there's the poem about I can't describe it. It's that thing, isn't it, of marrying two things that perhaps shouldn't be together,
yeah.
Putting them together, and how do you know that you've made the right marriage?
The Georg Trakl poem is maybe that's a case in point where it starts off with a picture of the German poet Georg Trakl, and then it goes into an analogy that's based on something that happened in the life of my dad, and probably the only connection is the fact that they're both called George. And it must have been something deep in my brain bringing that up, I don't know how, but it was just an analogy about depth, and there was something about the depth of expression in his eyes, and it must have come from there.
Yeah.
How? Who knows? That's lovely. In fact, I don't know.
No, I know. I mean, it can also bring a sort of anxiety in the sense of you can feel maybe you're pushing something too hard, and you know. And I suppose if you feel that anxiety, maybe that's a reason to not do that. But equally, there's that thing of taking a risk, as you say. And
also, time's a great thing. You know that sometimes you only really know whether it's come off, not at the time, but maybe months later when you go back to it and you think. And, you know, you're looking at it with a bit of distance and less attachment, and then you can see whether it's actually finished, whether it's, you know, you've had a completely overinflated opinion of it, or whether it's a lot better than you thought it, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So time's great for that, you know, just letting things sit for a while.
Yeah. And do you have a sort of particular way of writing or being, you know, is there anything that you... are you a walker like Wordsworth?
Sometimes poems have happened like that. Not so much recently. I think because of having twins has influenced the way I write an awful lot, because I've been so, so busy, and I'm a secondary school teacher as well, so I'm trying to do the writing around all of those things. My husband's a writer as well, so I'm trying to make sure that he gets a fair shot. You know, we both get a fair crack at the writing. So I heard this brilliant thing, or read this, I think I read it actually, Pascal Petit said something about you should write when you're ill, you should write when you're tired, you know, you should write in any circumstance, whatever, and that's what I tried to do, you know, to sort of, sometimes when my eyes are almost closing, I just try and, I look at some poetry and then just have my notebook open and then just like let what is in my head happen, and quite often nothing amazing happens and then sometimes something comes out of it, but it's just putting yourself in the way of it.
Is
what I've tried to do. Mm. Not always successfully, because sometimes you're just too plain exhausted to do anything. So that's my strategy, and then just to try and be as alert as I can to things in different circumstances, you know, and not limit myself too much to, you know. Wanting to write about everything, as I suppose what I mean.
Yes.
Anything and everything.
Yes, yes, that quality of alertness I thought was really strong in the two first poems you read, which were about that holiday thing, but they're just so vivid. It's that thing of how to make memories so vivid so that somebody listening can see them is really a thing.
Yeah. I think learning, the whole process has been about learning to really look and learning to see kind of all over again, and then trying to keep doing that, because you get into habits so quickly, I've found, that, you know, you can start to miss things again, and you have to keep sharpening it up.
I just wondered what your thinking was about breathings, what you get out of it and why you do it.
Readings, from my point of view, you start to almost be able to stand outside yourself a little bit and semi put yourself in the shoes of the audience, if you see what I mean. So again, it's a good way of getting some sort of distance and detachment from what you've been writing, and saying it out loud in front of a bunch of other people is very different from even reading it aloud to yourself in your room, you know. something happens to you when you connect with the other people. So it changes, sometimes changes the meaning of the poem even for me, depending on people's responses. It's also a reminder, you know, what you're writing for. You're not necessarily, you are writing for yourself, but it's not, you're writing for other people, and hopefully, even if it's just a tiny fraction of what you write connects with something in somebody else's experience, then you're doing something useful, hopefully. Thank you.
So I'd like to ask a bit. I felt particularly in this pamphlet, there's a lot of poems that are about. They have a lot of biblical references, and so yeah. there is a strong. And you talk a bit. You talked about Wordsworth and that thing of looking beyond them. And I suppose there's that sense of what is your. I would like to know what you. Is there a belief element, or is it a searching element, or what, or how is it working?
I did religious studies A level. I didn't do it at university, but I as part of that curriculum, I ended up reading a lot of the New Testament, because unlike the modern RE curriculums where you do comparative religion, that one was a very old fashioned one. Mm-hmm. So I did a lot of the Gospel of Mark, and so a lot of the Gospel of Mark seems quite ingrained in me, and there's bits of Acts and things like that. So the Bible element went quite deep in, but I've also been interested in things like Buddhism and things like that. I suppose it's more of a searching thing, and an attempt to understand what I'm living really in. Mm. But also, it's exploratory, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say. I'm not trying to find definite answers. It's just an exploratory thing.
Yeah. Because it does seem to be something that is emerging a lot in contemporary poetry. I don't know if you've felt that in things you've been reading, that poetry seems to be doing a lot of work, working very hard to try and speak to questions of, what are we here for, where are we going? I suppose it always has, but it used to perhaps be a religious poetry, so it used to be explicitly for that purpose.
I like that kind of element in poetry. I like that sense of not just writing personal anecdotes. I do write stuff that's happened to me, but I'm always trying to see into it, if you see, or see beyond it in some way. Somebody who's very precious to me is Charles Wright, where he, in a sense, there's almost no narrative whatsoever in that poetry, and it's almost all kind of. It's nature. There's nature in there. There's sort of philosophical musing in there. There's stuff about art, but it doesn't have that kind of narrative necessarily. Sort of beginning, middle, endish narrative thread to it. Yeah. So I like writers who are doing that sort of thing.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, the Anne Carson inspired poem you read had the very strong sense, didn't it, of a personal memory.
Yes,
but also very little, actually, because of this.
It's just a tiny thing.
Yeah.
I think Michael Donaghy said somewhere that, a poem can be sparked, I'm paraphrasing badly, but a poem can be sparked by something incredibly trivial, just the tiniest movement or, and this is what I found, that, something quite innocuous and quite colourless sometimes can just become something huge. You realise its significance as you start to write about it. It feels like nothing to begin with, and then as you carry on writing about it, it grows and becomes more luminous as you go further into the writing process.
Yeah,
hopefully, if it's working.
Yeah, well, I did love the idea of these women with the melting quality. It's really strong. I don't know if anyone else remembers that or felt that about it, and that love has an element of that, doesn't it?
Yeah, and that, I'm interested in things dissolving and falling away, and I suppose that happens quite a lot in the poems that I write. There are things just borders and sharp edges just blurring and fading out. Moriarty's kind of like that, that idea of this blurry outline that you can't quite grasp. You can't, you know, you want it to stand still for a second, and so you can really look at it and understand it.
Yes. Yes, and it sort of speaks a bit to that thing of making as well. Everything you make is constantly dissolving away from you. As you...
Even things that appear incredibly solid and very, very tangible can have that melting, that blur and that... There's the radiance about things as well.
So Mary first.
No, I was only going to say, following on from that, because when you were saying about looking, mm-hmm. and I realised that a lot of what I enjoyed about the things that you were reading is that I could somehow see them change as you looked at them, because you're looking at them so closely that they become something else, or they sort of develop other dimensions, and that I think is what I experience as the kind of numinous quality of poetry, mm-hmm. that it's a way of investigating things that changes them somehow.
And that just what you're dealing with is transience, you know, and trying to. I don't know about figuring it out, but just seeing that it's there, I think. Well, I think one of the big things that poetry does at the moment, it seems to me, is just to remind us of that, because our whole culture is geared around the idea of objects and things and acquiring objects and things and not really looking at their kind of transience, their impermanence. You know, we want this new thing, that new thing, but we're not actually looking at the whole process of time passing. All of this stuff is a distraction from the actual slipstream of life that we're in, whereas what poetry will do is it will just bring you up short and just make you see that the flow of the river kind of
that you're in,
and the connectedness, and sometimes the disconnectedness of things as well. You know, what I love about C.K. Williams, for instance, who's another huge hero of mine, is the fact that he'll often try and give you a memory, but then he'll kind of undo the memory as he's giving it to you and cast doubt on what he's actually saying, because and let one thing dissolve into another thing, you know. So he does it in My Mother's Lips, and an extraordinary poem which I teach to my sixth formers as well. It's kind of, it's shocking because it's about, you know, going to a prostitute for a blowjob, and you know, and they're like, but at the same time, I try and convince them that it sounds like the most sordid thing you could possibly imagine, and yet it's the most beautiful, innocent poem. And that miracle is achieved by the way that he deals with the passing of time in the poem, mm-hmm. and the fact that you go from him reflecting as an older man to actually deictically just sitting in a car with him. It's almost like you, the reader, are sitting next to him as this memory is happening, and then you go further back to what's happened in this kind of in the middle of New York in the middle of the night, and you go further back with him as he remembers it, but he only half remembers it, and this is the problem. He can't remember the woman's face, for instance. He only remembers the top of her head, and he's trying to remember because he wants to give her some this prostitute. He wants to give her some dignity. He wants to, you know, change what happened, and he can't. So the fragmentary nature of it, it's if you haven't read that poem, it's just amazing, because it's so forgiving as well. You know, he's done something that he's ashamed of, and yet you kind of see this sort of strange beauty in this, and it's that kind of stuff that I really admire, and that's what, you know, I'm kind of groping towards, I suppose, in some way, if I can. But yeah,
that's really lovely. I wish I had you as my sixth form teacher. Shirley, do you have a question?
I just wondered whether it's always been poetry for you, or whether you write stories or in other ways, or paint.
I wish, you know, there are about a million roads not taken there. I so envy painters and artists. You know, I have no talent for that whatsoever, but I really, really envy them. So I write a lot about artists as a result, really. I think it's just that I'm feeling like, oh God, I wish I could have done that instead. Maybe not instead, but as well as I'm greedy, I'd like to do all of it. I started I mean, I started with poetry when I was a kid. It was kind of greetings card rhyme type things. That's the earliest stuff I did, I think, as a kid. But initially, I thought I wanted to be a dancer. And I gave up dance. And when I was about 12, I was very, 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 very serious about it. And then all of a sudden, I went to a summer school, and there were lots of wonderful dancers there, and they seemed to be so much more engaged with it than me. And I thought, I just suddenly gave up after that. And then there was a kind of a horrible lull. And then I started to think about writing, and it was like writing took the place of dancing for me. And initially I thought it was going to be prose, because the first thing I tried to write was a novel, but really it always came back to poetry, really. Although I am starting to write more prose now, but in snatches of time, because time is just... Well, anybody who teaches secondary English will kind of appreciate this. That it's, I mean, I do 3 days a week, but it feels like five. So, there's snatches of time. That's why poetry is brilliant, because, you can... I mean, some of my poems are incredibly short, and just the fact of having found that moment to write a 2 or 3 line poem... That's amazingly liberating, when the daily grind is sort of getting you, getting to you. Just to be in the poetry space is wonderful. What did Michael Longley say? If poetry was a place, I'd go there. Well, that's exactly how I feel. Go there as often as possible. even if that, not necessarily always writing, but just actually having, I have it on in the car. I was listening to Kathleen Jamie on the way over here, and it's just, the whole experience is, for me anyway, transfigured by just listening to it, and I'm suddenly sharper and more alive, more alert from it. So
I think you recognise that. In fact, you've got a super poem here about writing, Capstone. It's a wonderful power poem.
Do you want me to read that?
Why not? I mean, considering, I thought of And Still I Rise, the Maya Angelou poem.
And this is kind of A-level religious studies, because it's referring to Mark 12, verse 10, so that, some of these verses that I kind of learnt from A-level is still there, along with the Wordsworth. So I'm very grateful for that. Capstone. If you were to tell me now, as the foxes emerge from their improvised dwellings, as night emerges with inestimable patience from under improvised day, to step down from this, desist, unmake what is made, and forbear from making what is not yet made, I would rise like oxygen in water. I would rise through all space and hold my face up to the moon as to a looking glass. Tell me I am not with the real, and this voice is not in the grain of life, and I will take this instant a nebula in my left palm and melt the deep cold of its cancelled fire merely with the heat of my hand, drinking all distance, making my body the chorus of time. And the very stones of my eyes would cry out then against you, and my flint tongue would strike sparks off pinnacle, capstone, firmament.
I was quite cross that one. Wonderful. I mean, a nebula in my left palm, and that just so lovely. And I think... it's lovely to that power like that in the poem, but the poems have, there is a lot of dark in your writing, I have to say, Italian, and yet it never ever feels at all gloomy to read. And I was sort of finding that, at times I was sort of looking at poems and I was sort of even noticing all the words that were sort of black or darkness, and then thinking, why am I loving this poem so much? It makes me feel... so great, I'm trying to find it. It's a great thing.
Well, I think I was going to say the Rothko poem. The black comes through as something, it just gets stronger and stronger. Sort of source of power rather than a darkness.
And I suppose that's the experience of the Rothko exhibit that I didn't understand at the time, was that, walking through these canvases that apparently all seem pretty much the same, and yet it's the cumulative effect of that, and that intensification. I suppose that's what it's about, you know, intensifying. And I suppose I've always gone after intensity, really. Whatever I was experiencing, whether it was dance or, you know, writing or whatever, I was kind of easily bored. But I could concentrate for long periods of time, but yet, you know, it's like I didn't want to stay on the surface of things. I just wanted to go deeper and deeper and deeper into things. That's the way I always was as a kid.
And there's a beauty in things like that black tarn in that poem, you know, which is a sort of gorgeous. I want to go into it. The idea of a sort of silky blackness is lovely,
but intensely painfully cold as well. But then on the other side of that, I don't know if any of you swim in cold water, but there's that, you know, you get the pain of going in there, and then afterwards there's a kind of a euphoria as you start to warm up. You know, it's just blissful, really wonderful. So I like the two sides of those things coming together, really. Sort of the pain and then the bliss balancing it out somehow.
Well, that's super, really lovely. Does anybody have a final question before I end? I think that was a really lovely place to end, actually, and so really fabulous reading and such a lovely generous and open conversation, and so much to take away and read and think about afterwards. So thanks very much.
Thank you. Thanks so much to you guys.